Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome more, some more Shout Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Monael Bay, and this evening we'll be dealing with federal and civil procedures. And our guest will be in this evening, Brother Kamitu U. Bay. And we're going to be covering a lot of ground here this evening. And I'm going to go ahead and open up the lines here.
Islam,
you ready to roll?
Yes,
I'm just fine, brother. Got a little technical difficulty on here. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. I just see it right here. Okay, I got it done. Need you to hold on 1 second, and then when I'm done, we'll be ready to roll. Okay?
Sound like a plan.
All right.
Islam, Hotel, Barigani. What's happening in peace? January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, we will have Summit of the Moors. This is a collective effort to bring about economic security that is a great opportunity for our people to forecast their own future, beginning with a collective approach that can benefit all. The educators, the speakers are all diverse to represent the people who are also diverse in their ideologies. On deck, we have Kadara Bay, Dr. Arlene Bay, Julani Bay, Tahaka Amina L. Bay, Abundance Child, Sundiata L., Daraya Bay, the Federation of Southern Cooperative, German Shannon L., Sharif Noble, and myself, Asar Dalo Sekou Abur L. Topics will be food security, such things as aquaponics, gold and silver purchasing, technology, cooperative application, the administrative process, and lots more. We also have what's called private side sessions. These sessions will not be recorded, any recording, audio or visual, for the public. You have to be in person in order to get these jewels. And we also have some special guests who didn't want to be advertised that will come and drop more information. I'm urging everyone to go to www.dalosekou.com and register. This is free. This is a free event. It is www.dalosekou.com, DialoSekou.com. January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, Summit of the Moors. Peace.
Okay, Brother Bay, we are ready to go. I know in our last conversation you was telling us about we had something new to bring to the table this evening, and I want to give thanks to Allah and thanks to you for being here on the broadcast so we can get some education going on here. So what's new, brother?
Oh, man, family. There's a lot of good information out there that's very liberating to our people, you know what I'm saying, and we have to, of course, show due diligence because, brother, you know, I always say, and I will say it again, that our people are being sanctioned. And ever since the Europeans came to these shores, well, we have been sanctioned as a people, and we cannot seem to get our economic conditions going. And that summit that you had mentioned, that you had shared with those as a commercial info, a very important summit, because we do need to have economic stability, brother, because if we don't have our own sovereignty and financial infrastructure, you know, brother, we're going to suffer. Every government on earth has some type of economic infrastructure to run the economy. I'm not saying the economy is stable, but they have something to run the economy, and we don't have nothing at all to be able to run our own independent economy, so that way we don't have to suffer at the fiscal cliff that the president keeps talking about. You know what I'm saying? Our fiscal cliff, brother, is that we are being sanctioned, and when we go up into these courtrooms, you know what I'm saying, the European and his judicial system is treating us under the concept of a debtor, all right? And he has control, or she has control up in these courtrooms. You know, Brother Tahaka, so, you know, it's a lot of information, brother, that the brothers and sisters need to be aware of, so that way they can be effective, you know, and have a change in their liberation, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I got a few little plugs lined up here that will pretty much show the importance, especially one that can showing us exactly what could happen in the case of getting a crooked judge. And then I got another one that shows a gentleman actually having studied, having gathered all the law, the proof, and laid it down in the courtroom and pretty much shut him down. I mean, he, you know, just the DA and the judge. So I want to run that. But it's one little thing that I want to run right now before we get started, get on down in this broadcast. And it's something that most of us need to be aware of that's going on now. So if y'all sit tight for a minute, we'll run this
not
right here.
Earlier this month, the California Supreme Court disappointed many civil liberties advocates when it reached a 5-2 decision in People versus Diaz. The police may lawfully search mobile phones on arrested individual persons without first obtaining a search warrant. It's particularly troubling when you think of how much personal information is stored on your phone. In this day and age, it's both your best friend and could be your worst enemy if it gets into the wrong hands. Videos, pictures, emails, text messages, contacts, you name it, all of your communications are in this one little device. So with this ruling, should we just call privacy completely dead? Or are there still a few tricks out there to keep your personal information safe? Earlier, I caught up with Ryan Radia, Associate Director of Technology Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And first, we painted the scenario. Let's say I got pulled over. I got arrested. I had my phone on me. Can cops really just do whatever they want with it?
That's correct. Under the decision 2 weeks ago by the California Supreme Court, along with actually a number of other courts over the last few years, anytime you are arrested by police for any reason, which could include unpaid parking tickets, driving without a seatbelt, reckless driving, the police can take your phone, arrest you, and once you're in custody under arrest behind bars, they can spend hours trying to search through your phone. Anything they find can be used against you in court, can be used for a search warrant.
And that's really scary, because when you think about it, this little tiny thing that I carry around with me, I mean, it holds so much of our personal information these days, right? Every email, every text message, every picture, every video. It's almost kind of scary how much we depend on these little things.
It's incredible how much data we store on our smartphones. Now, the courts have dealt with things like pagers for a while, but those are usually just a couple of phone numbers. The actual initial court decisions that allowed this to happen dealt with things like a cigarette pack. But today we're talking about a cell phone. Really, the cell phone of the smartphone, like an iPhone, contains your papers and effects of the digital age. The things that you would once store at home in a locked file cabinet in your desk, you don't have your Gmail, your text messages, your images. all this personal information is on your phone, and it's now vulnerable to law enforcement search without a court order, without a warrant at all.
I mean, it's definitely personal information. It's something that I consider private, you know, and it is a catch-22. It's so easy. You can carry it around all the time. But now, at the same time, it's very vulnerable, like you said. But you mentioned a few tricks as to perhaps how you could keep cops from actually getting hands on your phone. So let's say that I'm in my car and they choose to arrest me. What do you mean for the phone to be on my person? You know, if it's on the passenger seat laying there in the center console, does that count?
Unclear. Never really been tested. The technical language is, if it's immediately associated with your person, person searching, no questions asked, no need for what's called exigent circumstances. But if it's in your immediate control, but not immediately associated with your person, they can't search it. So the precedents on this are a little murky because it's such a new and untested area. But if it's in your luggage, they probably cannot search it unless they have a serious reason to think you're going to destroy data. So probably for a seatbelt or a weapons driving arrest. If it's in your console, glove compartment, luggage, they probably can't search it. If it's in your purse, however, next to you, maybe even on a seat, in the seat next to you, or definitely in your pocket, then they can search it. So your goal is to get it basically as far away as you can from your person in some separate object. Whether or not...
What about my phone case that covers it, right? That's a separate object, no?
It is. It's a really murky legal definition, whether it's in your grabbing space, on your person, separate from you. In fact, if it's in your trunk, it may even have an entirely different standard for search because you can't access it at all inside your car.
I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot of stories coming out, you know, about different people that had it somewhere else in their car and, you know, what the cops constituted is on your person or not. But what if I have a password on my phone so you can't just push the button and instantly access all the information? Can the officer actually force you to give them your password?
They can ask you, and they can even lie to you. They can say, if you tell us your password, it's going to help you when we go before the judge. Remember, cops, generally speaking, don't have to tell you the truth. However, and this is important, they cannot force you to hand over your password. They may ask, they may try to persuade you, but if they do force you and you hand it over, then they've gone over the line. However, if you voluntarily disclose it, then that's free reign to them. So I would advise everyone, if you're all worried about police looking at your phone, whether or not you committed a crime, which you probably don't know even if you have, given how many there are, but you should definitely password protect your phone. It's a great way to keep it safe.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I was reading your piece, you said that there's a lot of Americans that are probably saying, yeah, I have nothing to hide. Go ahead, search my phone. But you said that a lot of us are probably guilty of committing crimes, and we don't even know it. What do you mean by that?
There's so many laws on the books in the United States these days. There's something that's called over-criminalization. Every year, thousands of new offenses are added to the books. A lot of them don't require criminal intent. People have no idea you're doing something illegal. I mean, there are these horror stories that have been compiled by organizations like Fairly Foundation. That former Attorney General Ed Meeks, who worked under Reagan, not exactly a bleeding heart liberal. In fact, he's a long term conservative. He's written about this. A girl was arrested on New York City subway for eating a French fry. Arrested. A woman was arrested simply for not filing the right paper with her grandmother. So you can be arrested for a whole host of things, for not having the right stamp on a lobster you've imported. It's incredibly easy for the cops to find something you've done that's illegal. Not only that, if they search your phone and they find anything incriminating, such as the guy in California, Diaz, they were inside a text message. It said 648. That's all it said. The police officer testified that involved a drug deal. 6 pills for $80. That, along with other factors, is enough for a criminal conviction. So it's really hard to know for sure that there's nothing on your phone that might land you behind bars, given how many laws you got.
That is really crazy. So I guess the number one piece of advice that you're giving people is to actually go ahead and encrypt their phones. Isn't that right?
That's right. It's really easy to do that with your laptop, which I recommend everybody do because it's so easy. Just Google the phrase TrueCrypt, C-R-I-P-T. It's a great piece of software. It lets you encrypt your laptop. Police cannot break it. It's very robust. The problem is on phones, you really want that same level of encryption because police can't hack into it. The problem with a password-protected phone that's not encrypted is that there are these tools that police can plug into your phone. In 5 minutes, all the data is off your phone on their computer, and then they have free reign to search it. So encrypting it is the only really surefire way to make sure police can't access it. And as I said earlier, they cannot force you to compel to turn over the key. No matter what they say, you have the right to remain silent. They cannot force you to compel to disclose any information under the Sixth Amendment. So you really want to encrypt your phone. The problem is not not a lot of phones actually let you encrypt it. It's not an easy thing. It's not a common feature. As I mentioned, BlackBerry is probably the leader in this field, in large part because corporations, their main customers, really care about security. iPhones, not so easy to encrypt it.
Well, that's no good. I think maybe I need to throw out my phone. Well, no, I mean, you know, this is something that might even be coming in front of the Supreme Court at some time, but it's definitely, you know, good for people to know about what they can and cannot do, what they should and shouldn't do. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Okay. Brother, I'm back. Now, I have a question for you. Are you with me, brother?
Yes, I am, Noble. I'm over here.
Okay. Now, what about entering evidence into a court case? And how do we deal with that when it comes to if it's evidence that we don't want to be revealed? How do we go about handling that? If it's in the hands of the prosecutor.
Well, Noble, that's a good question. And for those who are listening, and I'm sure that those who are in the process or might have heard about a process, there's what you call a motion to suppress evidence.
Uh-huh.
They have it on the state level, and they have it on the federal level. So if any evidence that they obtain they're going to use against you, you can file a motion to suppress. But it's also very important that when you do file a motion to suppress, regardless if it's on the state level, local level, or federal level, you always make sure that you support that motion to suppress with what you call a memorandum of law. A memorandum of law is case laws that support why you can suppress the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So it's a plethora of cases. You know, most likely those cases have been what you would call shepherdized, and you can show other instances where cases have been taken someone and been put into evidence to use against you. And so and there are, of course, a number of cases that supports that motion to suppress. And you would use those cases in the memorandum of law argument, all right, especially when it comes to cases that's been already on the circuit level or on the appeals level. You can use those cases to support your motion to suppress that. You know what I'm saying? And that's how you handle that, Brother Sahaka, because most of the brothers and sisters who may get caught up in that and that evidence was taken from them and it's going to be used against them, they're not aware that you can file a motion to suppress that information. You know what I'm saying? But you have to have a memorandum of law, which means there was other cases in point and in question that suppressed that evidence, whatever's being brought against you, and the court rule in that case favor. So you bring those memorandum of law in support, because if you just use the motion alone to suppress, chances are that motion can be defeated.
Mm-hmm.
But if you show a memorandum of law to the judge, and he sees that there were other cases, just like evidence to be suppressed, the chances are that that motion would be granted. So it's very important to be aware of that.
Okay.
You know, very important. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, you said that the chances of getting that to happen is better. Would you say it's better in the federal courts or state courts, or is it really doesn't matter?
What I'm saying, Noble, evidence or information or property that's been taken into evidence that's going to be used against you, I'm saying it can happen either on a local level, it can happen on a state level, or it can happen on a federal level. So I just want to address all three levels, because a lot of us is in these local courts. Some of us may be in the higher courts, which is the Superior Court or the Supreme Court. all right, and either on a federal court level. So what I'm doing is covering all the courts that you may possibly be in where evidence may be used against you. So it may be on a local level, noble, mm-hmm. it may be on a state level, or it may be on a federal level. But what I'm specifically articulating, Brother Tahaka, so the people mm-hmm. won't be confused, is that you have to file a motion to suppress, a motion to suppress that evidence that's being taken to be used against you, but you have right. to have case law. The case law will be used as a memorandum of law. You will use it as a memorandum to remind the judge that there were previous cases that's res judicata, which means cases that have been already ruled on and finalized by a judge that those evidence can be suppressed, all right? And it don't make a difference what level you on. It can be in a local court, a state court, or a federal court, a motion to suppress with a memorandum of law that supports that motion to be granted. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. So if the prosecution attempts to use some evidence, let me make sure I understand this. Now, anytime there's going to be evidence entered into a court case, and it's going to be presented by the prosecution, the attorney, public lawyers, or whatever you have. Don't both parties have to have knowledge of this evidence before it's ever presented in the courtroom?
Yes, Noble. But then what we have to look at too, Brother Tahaka, are we talking about a civil court or are we talking about a criminal court? Because 9 times out of 10, a civil court disclosure of information and evidence would be most likely different from a criminal court, because in the criminal court, they're going to be using evidence that's going to be damaging to you, and you want to minimize any damage that they may use against you because you're trying to abate the case to be dismissed. But if mm-hmm. it's a civil court, all right, if it's a civil court, 9, 10, and 10, if you're making a claim, they're going to want you to disclose that information to substantiate your claim if it's a civil case. So that's something different. So we don't want to say that, oh, we want to file a motion to suppress with a memorandum of law in a civil case. You know, it doesn't work in that due process. I'm referring to it in a criminal case. So let me articulate that if any evidence, and usually what you're saying, Brother Tahaka, is from a criminal perspective, because the information that you were displaying with a person being arrested and the police officer takes one cell phone and it can be a load of information on that cell phone that they tap into by reprogramming the phone to try to get the information out of there, all right, can be evidence used against you. So now 9 to the 10, of course, that's going to be in a criminal proceeding. So that's what I want people, those who are listening, recognize that when we talk about suppressing evidence, that's 9 to the 10, that's going to be on a criminal proceeding, be it on a local level, be it on a state level, or being on a federal level. You can put in a motion to suppress that evidence with a supporting memorandum of law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now let's go over here. Let's say that mortgage situation. Let's say you send a check for the mortgage payment to you, the company, and they sent your check back to you. Say, well, we sent it back to you because you behind, that you need an attorney. What kind of situation? How would you go about handling that?
If I hear you correctly, Tahaka, all right, and you stated that if it's a mortgage scenario, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you send a check to the bank concerning the mortgage, and you said something about they sending the check back. You're saying, mm-hmm. How do you handle this scenario?
Yeah. How do you?
All right, I just want to make sure that I'm clear that I heard you, because I don't want to respond to something that you didn't say. So I just repeated that to make sure that I hear you properly. All right, and then I don't want people to be confused about the question you asked me previously, because I don't want them to think that would you file a motion to suppress that. You follow mm-hmm. me? So we have to be careful of how we ask questions, because one deals with a criminal matter and the other one is civil. So a question you're asking me is a civil question, so a motion to suppress won't be associated to what you're asking me. Now, what happens is this. When there's a case law. Now, that's a good question you asked me, Brother Tahaka. And I gotta go back and look. You gotta go back and look up this information, because it's been so many years ago that I came across this case law. Because I do a lot of case law studies in order to these attorneys in the courtroom. There's a case law that says that a debt paid. A dead debt is a debt paid, which means that if you pay a debt by sending in payment and the bank or any of the creditors, let me speak in general, because it doesn't necessarily have to be a mortgage, because people may say, well, I wonder if that works with a student loan or if that works with a credit card, you know what I'm saying, or any other business out there. So any creditor, all right, just like a mortgage, as Brother Tahaka is asking me, if you send in a payment for that debt, and they return back that payment for that debt is considered to be paid, because a creditor by law is not supposed to refuse any payment. Any payment, all right? And so there's a case law that shows that once you send that payment in and they send the payment back, that debt or that payment for that debt is considered to be paid.
Okay. All right. So make sure that we get that on the board. Now, I see we got a caller with his hands raised. I'm going to open up the line here for a minute. Now, I see what you are. Area code 347. Could you tell us who you are? What's your question or comment?
Hello. Could you hear me?
Got a lot of background in the noise now. Got a lot of background noise there.
All right. I'm going to make this quick. It's Cell Fluid calling from Brooklyn. I got a question about the motions you're talking about. Is there another description you could use other than a motion? Because can't motions be denied? Doesn't it have to have like some sort of vote behind it in order for it to be granted?
All right, Noble, listen to this. You're going to have to speak up a little louder, because like Tahaka said, we see filtered noise in the background, and we have to you have to speak up a little louder. I hear some of what you're saying, but I'm not catching everything what you're saying.
Speak
a little louder into the phone.
Okay, as far as the motions that you were speaking of, is there another description that you could use other than a motion? Because can't motions be denied? Doesn't it have to take some type of vote in order for it to be granted?
I hear what you're saying. Yes, motions could be denied, and I do agree with what you're asking me. But what I'm saying to you is this, family. I specifically stated, so you know what's going on, and I'm only telling you from experience, when you do case law studies, because one thing that I have not heard anybody speak about, and you can bear witness this for yourself, I have not heard anybody of our brothers and sisters ever talk about case law studies. And you can look up case law studies, and you can shepherdize those cases, all right? Or 9 times out of 10, those cases are shepherdized. And you will find cases and scenarios where you are similarly situated where a motion was granted. So what I'm saying is, family, here's the science. Look and study to find out where the motion was granted, all right? When you see that the motion was granted and you are similarly situated where a motion have to be applied to press certain evidence, use that case law in a memorandum of law to the judge. Now, the point is, once the judge reads the memorandum of law showing that that motion was granted and your motion is similarly situated as that motion, 9 to 10, the judge is going to grant your motion. So, yes, I do agree that motions can be denied. But what I'm saying is what we have not learned is to do case law studies to find out cases, right, that would show that your motion can be granted. And who is good and famous for that is you'll find jailhouse lawyers or inmates always looking for cases that is similarly situated as their circumstances, and they wind up getting what? Released from jail. These are the same information that I'm giving you, brother, is what inmates use to be released from jail, all right? Because they find cases that similarly they are situated, and they will use those cases and their motions, and when the court hears the case and see the memorandum of law and see that they're similarly situated and you bring in the same argument, 9 out of 10, the court will grant it. This is what I'm saying, family.
Okay, I hope that answered the brother's question. I had to mute the mic, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring a little piece in, and this explains exactly what you're talking about. This is a gentleman just like you and I. He's not an attorney, but he has did the research. He's done the case law research, and he's going to recite it before a judge and the DA, and on every conceivable turn. And just pretty much shut them down. I want you to see how it's done, family.
Mr. Falkowski, did you want to take up Mr. Alexander's matter? Mr. Alexander, case number 375134. Oh, hang on just a second, Mr. Falkowski. Mr. Alexander has asked for a video of the proceedings.
Excuse me, are you attempting to serve me something, sir?
Your Honor, for the record, I gave Mr. Alexander some advance sheets.
Your Honor, I would object at this time.
Well, it was just additional authority that came to my attention after I filed my response. I basically am in court.
Objection, Your Honor. I'm the moving party, and I'd like to address the court before Mr. Falkowski says another word. And based on situation and circumstances.
Would you like to sign this first?
I'm sorry, sir. I can't do that.
Well, can't use the case, sir.
Although procedurally I may be somewhat out of order, I would ask it be set over until Friday, since one of the rights that Mr. Alexander is stating that I'm violating is this right to counsel on the underlying contempt action, and if it was continued until Friday, a public defender would be present and could advise him on that issue. I think that's the first issue we should take up, is whether or not he's representing himself or whether or not he wants a public defender appointment.
Mr. Alexander, you know I can't proceed without a stipulation. Do you wish me to send this over to the presiding judge?
Your Honor, if I may briefly address the court.
Okay, it will have to be brief, Mr. Alexander.
Briefly, Your Honor.
Because I do have four trials.
Pursuant to documents filed in the United States District Court this day, Fresno County Superior Court judges in bank, including all, the full court, are named expect adverse parties in a federal class action lawsuit. Thus, it would be inappropriate for any Fresno County Superior Court judge to hear this case. Equally, it is my intent, pursuant to my authority under California Penal Code, Section 837, to place Mr. Falkowski under citizen's arrest.
On what basis, sir?
Violation of Penal Code Section 166, as well as 422.6, 422.7. At this point in time, I am additionally requesting that a peace officer of the state of California takes an individual who I now deliver into custody. You may sign a modification for Penal Code Section 849, Sub B1. That's your discretion. Additionally, Your Honor, I will leave the court a copy momentarily, my personal file copy of said petition under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 27.5 instead of federal court. I will be additionally showing over to the presiding judge and bank.
Tom, if you could
hand me
a copy of that, Mr. Alexander,
please. Now, I would like to have this back, Your Honor, and while the matter is under consideration, I would like to depart from the courtroom, proceed with my associates across the street to serve the presiding judge. Also, my associate here today has a duplicate copy from which we would like to serve on the court. Therefore, I request that these documents, whatever they are, be returned to Mr. Falkowski, and I am willing to determine how we proceed such appropriate service to things that can. I believe, Your Honor, that Mr. Falkowski, everyone in the attorney's office, pursuant to this federal rules of civil procedure, will place on petition as well as every judge in the Fresno County Court System, sitting in bank, has a personal interest in the outcome of this matter, and therefore, would be inappropriate and create a conflict of interest. In the event I'm wrong, I would like a minimum of 2 days to prepare the 170.186C sound for cause against each and every judge in the Fresno County Superior Court system.
I'd go along with his request to continue the case for a couple of days until Friday. I think that's what should be done. I haven't had enough. Has this actually been filed? It was.
My copy indicates that it has been lodged with the clerk of the U.S. District Court.
Miscellaneous cases as such are initially set before a magistrate, which has been explained to the federal court clerk to be inappropriate. The case has been titled for courtroom one for the Honorable United States District Court Judge Robert E. Coyle. When cases as such and a petition as such are filed, they are assigned at the interim in miscellaneous case number, and therefore they are only logged and not officially filed until it actually goes to the magistrate and then proceeds to the federal court judge for review. At that point in time, it will be assigned a permanent case number from which the following class action lawsuit will additionally be titled under the same case number.
Again, I was just given a copy of it a minute ago, and there's no named defendants.
Suspected adverse parties, I believe, are listed on page 6. Defendants are not, Your Honor, in such a petition to be identified as actual defendants, rather are to be listed as expected adverse parties. And that is in compliance with Federal Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 27.
I'm sorry, on page 6?
Excuse me, page 8, number 4, James Falkowski, Deputy District Attorney, County of Fresno, ETAL, Family Support Division, number 77777, P.O. Box.
Thank you, I found it.
Now, Mr. Alexander, you said these were your copies.
That is my personal copy, Your Honor, that is correct. Serving the presiding judge and bank would then be his obligation to make the duplicate copies and forward them to every single judge associated.
Tom, if you could return this to... This matter is continued without prejudice to any pending interest before the court to Friday, October the 25th at 1:30. And I guess the first issue that we'll take up is the pendency of an action that might require proceedings in this court being stayed while the federal court addresses Mr. Alexander's question. So Mr. Alexander, we'll see you back here on Friday at 1:30.
Your Honor, I got the name of the gentleman, Dennis, who served me with the papers. I'd like, you said he was your associate?
He is at this time now to be considered as a prospective co-plaintiff in the class action for which I have been asked to represent such federal interest and rights at stake in the matter.
Okay, as a prospective co-plaintiff, I'd ask that he give me his address so that I would know how to contact him.
Sure, my address is California. Phone number?
Okay, and are you participating in the citizen's arrest?
No, sir, he is not.
You're not participating?
No, sir, he is not.
He can answer for himself.
No.
You're not participating?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Falkowski, I would reserve to you, having had Mr.
identified today as a prospective co-plaintiff. I'm not certain what, if any, effect that would have upon the validity of service by a party. You would, of course, be, I would reserve simply as a procedural matter your right to object to that service if he is, in fact, deemed to be a party to the action.
Your Honor, having not directly considered that at the moment, we could return that document and Mr. you'd like to serve him?
Just a second. Mr. Falkowski, you're excused. Mr. Alexander, this matter is continued to Friday at 1:30.
Thank you, Your Honor. Is Mr. Falkowski being taken into custody pursuant to my deliverance to this California peace officer?
Mr. Falkowski is subject to the jurisdiction of this court, and he will respond when the court orders him to do so.
Let the record reflect as such, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
When may I obtain my video copy of today's proceedings, Your Honor?
As soon as the proceedings are concluded, we'll pull the tape out and give it to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll return at the end of the court's business this day. Thank you.
It wasn't
on record because you guys proceeded before the tape was changed.
Isn't that amazing?
I can make that copy off that tape at the end of the day, and I will give you a call, and you will have your picture.
Thank you kindly, yeah.
Okay, brother, we're back. I think the dude handled himself pretty well up in there. We got a couple of people with their hands raised, but what's your take on that, man?
Well, Noble, the sound quality wasn't too clear.
Okay.
I was trying to make out, you know, what was being said. I did hear a bunch of case law being cited. But I couldn't really make it out, Noble. I'll say at this time, you can try to elaborate on what that was about, because you did make mention briefly just before you started to play it out. And like I said, I tried to hear it as much as possible and listen in on it, but it was really not clear and it was not loud. I mean, the judge was loud. It was a female judge. And
yeah.
I did hear things that she said. I did hear the defendant citing case law. And the other side, the adversary, I couldn't really hear what he was saying, so it was not really loud and clear for me to hear it. I don't know if anybody else have heard it better than I did, but if you can elaborate what that was about, Tahaka, I can give you my summation or my summary on that issue.
All right. Well, actually what happened, DA was pretty much unprepared for this guy to come in, and he did recite case law. He brought several discrepancies up involving the civil procedure. He had also pulled the oath of office of the judge, and he's providing all the documentation and duplicate to all the other judges associated with the case. But he handled himself very, very well. In the end, the prosecutor didn't really have anything to work with, but he wanted to have the guy turned over to the officers for incarceration until the next court date. But the judge overruled that and said, I'm going to let him do like I say. And instructed the DA to leave the courtroom. And so that's pretty much what happened. I'm going to go ahead and get to these callers here, and then we can get back and see if we can deal with it.
All right.
Area code 434. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment? 434. Area code 570. Can you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment? 570. You're on the air. Area code 402. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment? Area code 402.
Yeah. Bless us. How you doing, Tahaka and
hey,
Mitchell? This is Prentice from Nebraska, and I was wondering, my question was, do we study all forms of law by itself or all individual laws that coincide as international commerce?
You catching, brother?
You hear me?
You wanted to know, do we study all these laws by itself or come again? Say that one more time, brother, because I'm trying to make sure
it is.
I'm hearing what I've heard.
Okay. I'm gonna speak a little louder. Do we study all forms of law by itself or understand all laws coinciding as international commerce?
Oh, I got what you're saying.
Yeah.
They're really one of the same because they're all dealing with commerce. So they really are one of the same. So it's what I'm saying is best to cover the spectrum because all these laws are dealing with commerce. All right? Civil law or criminal law, they're all dealing with commerce. So technically, they're all the same, Noble. So there's really no separation.
Okay.
All the forms, because and the reason why I'm saying it so you'll be clear to you is because their whole purpose, brother, all right, when you go to Article 3, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, it says that judicial authority shall extend in all cases in law and in equity. So there you go, that all forms of law would be based upon equity. You see what I'm saying? And if you're talking about equity,
all right,
then you're definitely talking about commerce. So there's no court in any form, be it civil or criminal, that's not going to proceed in a proceeding that's not going to be equitable to the court. That wouldn't be.
Now, that's international as well. Am I correct? I don't mean to
interrupt
you, but is that international as well?
International as well. Not last Sunday, but the Sunday before last, if you heard what I stated, I brought up two instances, and this is an international case, about Argentina. Argentina economists were specifically stating that they would have to appeal the judge's ruling from here. Thomas Grisser was the judge who made a ruling from the U.S. District Court in Manhattan, Southern District, ruled against the state government of Argentina being in debt to the United States in reference to these bonds. And, of course, the economists of Argentina said that the fund that they have gotten from the U.S. was a vulture fund. So where do you see that language? Go to investopedia.com and you type in vulture funds, and you're going to see exactly the language. And this is on an international level. And it showed another nation state issue, judicially spoken of, is Mexico ruled against an American corporation called Yahoo, who breached their fiduciary duty to the contractors in Mexico. So the Mexican court ruled in the favor of the Mexican citizens, and so Yahoo stated, which is a U.S. corporation, that they're going to have to appeal the Mexican government's court decision. So again, judicially, yes, it's on an international level too, just besides a local level within the states or within the states of other foreign countries. So it's basically the same thing, brother.
Okay. Just one more question, one or two more questions, if you don't mind. So are you saying that we should start federally and work ourselves down, or as far as our studying, we should start federally as the courts are, as you're saying, as far as court procedures?
What I'm saying is, the question you're asking, it depends on what venue you're going to be operating in when it comes to litigation.
That's another thing I wanted to ask you, the whole venue thing. Is there a difference between venue and jurisdiction? And you were speaking about that, I believe, last week. I was wondering if you could break down the venue part more, make more understanding of it, make it more clear of the difference between the venue and the jurisdiction, please.
Yes, I'll break that down for you, brother. And there's a distinction between.
Yeah, I'm gonna get off the line so I can free up some things, but I'm still listening, y'all.
Yes,
I'm still listening.
Yes, thank you for that question. You can be in the same jurisdiction, like for instance, Brother Tahaka. Sunday before last had played a piece on Brother Shyam, where he was in one of the local courts in New Jersey, and if you was listening in on that, the judge specifically make mention that he filed a notice of removal, right? And that notice of removal is to remove the case from her court into a federal court. So the venue that he had to argue his case in based upon his damages and his claim was not in that court. So when he said that she didn't have jurisdiction, all right, he's right on what he's saying, but he had to remove it to another venue, all right? He had to remove it from the local state venue into a federal venue. You follow me? But even though those are two different venues, they're still in the same jurisdiction because they're still within New Jersey. All right, so that's the federal court in New Jersey, and that's the local state court still in New Jersey. So it's the same jurisdiction, but two different venues. One was a local court venue, and the other one was a federal court venue. So he was in the wrong venue, all right? He was in the wrong venue, so he had to change venues in order to argue his case. All right, because to argue his case before the venue that he was in, which was the local court, all right, was not the appropriate venue for him to argue. So that's the reason why the judge made mention that he removed the case, you know, by notice of removal, you know, because she was even aware that if he was making that claim, it would have had to be moved from that venue to a federal venue. All right, I want to make mention of that so you'll see the distinction between the two. Now, the venue can still be in the same jurisdiction. You follow me? Because the state of New Jersey is actually the jurisdiction of both those courts. One is one is local, or state, local, and you also have federal, which is the same jurisdiction, but could be three different venues. You have the local venue, local court venue, the state court venue, and then you have the federal court venue. So you have three different venues. Right, but the same jurisdiction, all right? So even though he may say, this court don't have jurisdiction, true, but that means you have to put in a change of venue, all right? So the federal court will be the venue to argue his case in reference to that jurisdiction, all right? So that's the difference between the venue and jurisdiction, all right, so people could be clear. Also, too, Brother Tahaka, the brother under the area code 347, prior to this brother asking the question, he asked me, was there another form they can go up under other than a motion, all right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't think about it at the time that he asked me, but bells started ringing off in my head. Yes, brother, there are another form that you can use other than a motion, that you can use, and that is called judicial notice. All right, since you were in New York, because 347 is an area code in New York, all right, you can go to Civil Practice Law and Rules 4511. All right, Rule 4511 is called judicial notice of law. All right, and you can go to Matthews and Bendis. You can go to a law library and go to Matthews and Bendis. When you go to Matthews and Bendis are the civil practice forms. There are forms to give you the format or the template on how to use the procedure of 4511. So that's all you got to do is go to Article 45 and go to Rule or Section 4511. They will give you a format, a template that you can use, and then you can use your memorandum of law to accompany a judicial notice of law, which is 4511 of the CPLR. All right, so you could use that form, and that's something else that Brother Cheyenne could have done in the court too. Instead of filing an affidavit or either a motion, you can also put a court on judicial notice. All courts in the United States and in the state have what you call a judicial notice. Even the federal court have a judicial notice, so you don't have to file a motion. So if a motion is something that's plaguing Moors, one thing that Moors need to be aware of, and if you're saying that the court don't have jurisdiction, you don't file motions and the court don't have jurisdiction. So it's very important to be aware of that. So if that court don't, because remember now, affidavits is actually in their statutes. It's in their statutes. So when she stated that he didn't file an application in support of his affidavit, all right, because that's the procedure that they use in that forum. So if you don't, if you're saying that the court don't have jurisdiction, you are not supposed to file a motion, and you're not supposed to file an affidavit. Filing an affidavit wouldn't be appropriate either, all right, because you have those who may mention about a motion, but an affidavit wouldn't be correct either. So what you would be filing, which no more out there have ever told you this, and for those who are listening, listen well, you will file a judicial notice, which means you're putting the court on notice that they don't have jurisdiction. You don't file an affidavit, all right? If anybody's familiar with the philosophies and opinions of Marcus Garvey, which I have the book on page 167 and 168, Marcus Garvey filed a motion. The court denied Marcus Garvey's motion. Why? Because the affidavit was not in compliance with the statute. So Moors were giving wrong information about you don't file affidavits. I mean, you don't file motions, correction. You don't file motions, you file affidavits. That's incorrect, too, because, again, go to the opinions, the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey. Go to page 167 and 168, all right? The last paragraph on 167, and it goes to the top of the paragraph on 168, and you'll see that Marcus Garvey himself had filed a motion, and the judge denied Marcus Garvey's motion. Why? Because his affidavit was not in compliance with the statute, all right? So if you're going to talk about the court don't have jurisdiction, you can't file no affidavit either, well as a motion that you're claiming. So what do you file? That's the question. And that's one of the major problems that Moors across the country is being told that you file affidavits, and that's incorrect. I would be the first Moor that you would hear tell you that you won't file an affidavit in the courtroom, because I was in a situation myself, and I didn't use no affidavit in the courtroom. What I used is a judicial notice, and I got my case dismissed on judicial notice. And matter of fact, it bothered me that when the judge did receive my judicial notice, and when I had to go to court, an attorney who was assigned to the case, not to me, but to the case, he tried to take it over from me, just like they was trying to do to Cheyenne, all right? I filed a judicial notice, and when I went to court, the judge called up the counsel who was on the case and said, "Counsel, did you receive this in the mail from Mr. Bay?" The counsel said, "No, Your Honor, I didn't receive that from Mr. Bay." "But what is that, Your Honor, a motion?" So the judge said, "A motion? Counsel, you don't know what a motion is?" So that wasn't a motion. That was a judicial notice, and I got my case dismissed on judicial notice. I didn't file no affidavit, and I didn't file no motion. I filed a judicial notice. And the only thing I didn't like about that case that I had dismissed is because it wasn't recorded on the minutes when the judge questioned the counsel counsel, you don't know what emotion is? That would have been something to have to show the Moors that that counsel didn't even know what emotion is, because that was not a motion. That was a judicial notice, and I dismissed my case. So I just wanted to put that out there, Brother Tahaka.
Okay, brother. Now, I want to go to another situation. I think this here will come across a little bit better. I'll test it and make sure, and if it doesn't, then we'll cut it off and we'll move forward. But before we do, I want to, if you would let the brothers and sisters out there listening to the broadcast know how they can get in touch with you, how they can make contact with you, if you would, please.
Yes. 347-626-1357. That's 347-626-1357. That's one way you can contact me through phone. If I don't pick up right away, it's a possibility my phone could be charging or I could be on another call. So you can also text me at that same number. All right? Not all the time I'm going to be in a position to answer you right away. And this time I'm going to answer you right away, because I'm bombarded with so many calls and so many questions on the line with so many brothers and sisters across the country, thanks to Brother Tahaka's Blog Talk Radio Show. And you can also reach me by email, which is fieldymure, which is French for the Moors, at F like in Frank, U like in umbrella, R like in red, D like in David, E like in Eric, M like in mom, U like in umbrella, I like an ID, R like in red, at yahoo.com. That's my email. It's FURDEMUIR at yahoo.com. You can email me also if you're trying to reach me. Please.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I forgot to mention for you all to, in order to access my free articles, just go ahead and send me a your email to tahaka53@hotmail.com. That's tahaka53@hotmail.com, and we'll rush those to you. The 14th Amendment Exposed, Commerce Game, and How to Play in the History of the United States and its Bankruptcy. And it's very important for us to get a look at the structure of what's going on so that we will know, have that ammunition in the backdrop to begin to work from in your education and law. Now, also, the information that you're hearing here tonight is taken straight out of my archives. You can study some of these cases right inside there. The cases we've done with Cheyenne Matata pushing the L in them, that is in there as well. Also, the way to access that, just simply contact me, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get you in there. That's area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get you in there. Now, we got another caller with his hand raised, but before we do, we're going to take a little quick break, and we'll be right back.
Islam, Hotel, Barigani. What's happening in peace? January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, we will have Summit of the Moors. This is a collective effort to bring about economic security. That is a great opportunity for our people to forecast their own future, beginning with a collective approach that can benefit all. The educators, the speakers are all diverse to represent the people who are also diverse in their ideologies. On deck we have Kadara Bey, Dr. Aline Bey, Julani Bey, Tahaka Amina L. Bey, Abundance Child, Sundiata L., Daraya Bey, the Federation of Southern Cooperative, German Shannon L., Sharif Noble, and myself, Asar Dalo Sekou Abur L. Topics will be food security, such things as aquaponics, gold and silver purchasing, technology, cooperative application, the administrative process, and lots more. We also have what's called private side sessions. These sessions will not be recorded, any recording, audio, or visual for the public. You have to be in person in order to get these jewels. And we also have some special guests who didn't want to be advertised that will come and drop more information. I'm urging everyone to go to www.dalosekou.com and register. This is free. This is a free event. It is www.dialosekou.com. DialoSekou.com. January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, Summit of the Moors. Peace.
Okay, I'm going to open up the line and see who we got here. Area code 313. Area code 313. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment?
Yeah, this is CJ Kemp. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. I had a question or two regarding of administrative process.
Okay.
Like I was wondering, okay, once you've done your process and you've got a judgment and agreement in the private, I've heard of technology where you're taking that in possibly to a federal court or whatnot for a judicial review. And I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay,
you want to elaborate on it? Can I tell you, you want me to talk on it?
No, you go ahead, brother.
Now, question, Noble. Why the federal court as opposed to the state court? Because the reason why I'm asking that question is because if there's a judgment, the question was the judgment in federal venue or was the judgment in state venue?
Well, the judgment was of the actual process, like done privately between the parties, where there's a default judgment by tacit acquiescence.
Yeah,
okay,
true.
It
all depends more where, if the parties are within the same state or if the parties are from a different state, because if you in Detroit and the parties in New York, yes, I would use a federal process to execute that.
Okay.
If the parties within the same state of Detroit, then you would execute that on the state level. So that's why I'm asking that question in reference to the administrative process.
Okay, but one particular process actually deals with parties, like the respondents were some in-state and some out-of-state. Like they're all parties to the same procedure, though.
I got you. So these are parties from out-of-state is what you're saying, correct?
Yeah, as well as in-state.
As well as in-state.
Right.
So, and you say that this administrative procedure was a private administrative procedure?
Yeah, just, you know, private communication between the parties with a notary witness and everything.
And I got you, and I got you. And that can be executed because that actually is law. When you use the notary process, which I'm familiar with, all right, you can have a judicial review on that, which you're correct. And you can, depending on which way you want to go, you can take it in the state level in Detroit or you can take it in the federal level because of the parties being outside of that state. So it can be either venue, Noble, for judicial review.
Okay. Now what I'm totally ignorant on is the actual process of going for the review. Like is there a public forum or is this like a rogatory or something to a particular judge?
Yeah, well, and I hear what you're saying. What's going to happen, Noble, when I hear what you're asking, when you have a notary process on the parties and that other party defaulted, all right, and you're doing from a notary protest, a notary resentment, is correct?
What?
You're doing it from a notary resentment, correct?
Yes.
All right, because what happens in notary, because if you're doing a private administrative due process
right,
by notary resentment, that means that everything is going to be done through the notary. The notary's address is going to be used, and the party's going to communicate through the notary process, all right?
Right.
When
right.
the other party defaults in reference to that notary process, what you have to do is take all the original correspondence and you have to file that under an index number or docket number within the state forum. All right. Now, it also depends on the amount, too. It depends on the amount. I don't know, because I know that in the state level, depending on what amount that's in controversy is going to determine what level you can hear it on. Like, for instance, if it's under 1,000, you know, like in New York State, of course, or 1,000, it says small claims court, all right?
Right.
If it's 5,000, it's still small claims court. But anything over 5,000 would automatically go to a civil court, all right?
Okay.
The civil court can hear only up to 10,000. Now, anything over 10,000 would have to go to the Supreme Court. So I'm giving you an example that whatever the amount in controversy is going to determine what court can hear the process. So I don't want to give you information to go to a certain venue to execute the process and not knowing what is the amount in controversy. And, you know, and so that's something you need to find that out. You need to call the court over there and find out what is the amount in controversy you can hear, and it can give you a determination on what venue you have to go to and execute your administration your administrative process.
Right, right. Okay, so let me understand. So over 10,000 is a Supreme Court venue?
Yeah. If it's 10,000, it's definitely the Supreme Court venue. I mean, you're in Detroit, so they may do things differently over there. Over here, it's civil court, right?
Okay.
If it's 25,000, it's definitely the Supreme Court, but the civil court can hear 10,000. So we have a small claims court, then we have a civil court, and then we have a Supreme Court. So depending on what the amount is going to determine what court venue you can bring your administrative process to.
Yeah, it's definitely high. It's in the multi-millions there.
Okay, well, that goes to the Supreme Court.
Is correct.
Now, that's for the actual review?
Yes, because what happens is, what you're doing is you want to be able to bring in your action on judicial review, all right? In New York, they call that RJI. RJI is called Request for Judicial Intervention. That's what you would call a judicial review, right?
Okay.
So that's what you're going to execute. And when the judge review that, he's going to automatically make the ruling in your favor because you already went through the process already.
Okay.
The only thing he's going to do is give you what you call is a judicial judgment.
Judicial judgment, okay.
Yeah, that's basically what you're seeking for, a judicial, because you are going to already be a creditor.
Okay,
listen to this, because you need to know this. What you're seeking for is a judgment by the court. You're looking for a judicial judgment. But
right.
In your case, you don't have to do that. You can do what you call is a non-judicial proceeding. All right.
Exactly.
Right. And so I know where you at, and I know what you're asking me. So you don't have to technically bring it to the judge. What you can do, right, since you already did what you call is the notary presentment or the notary process, what you do is you purchase an index number, Noble.
Okay.
You purchase an index number. But see, there's other things that you're going to need to do also, right, which means it's called an assignment of judgment. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's called an assignment of judgment.
Okay.
All right. Now, in the assignment of judgment, you will be called the judgment creditor, and the other party will be called the judgment debtor. You got me?
Okay. I got you. I'm with you.
What I'm saying, I'm giving you what you call is an administrative process, which is a non-judicial process, which means you don't have to bring it before judicial review. What you can do is, if it's already been done before a notary public, all right, it's already documented as law. So you don't have to go to a judge because what you're doing is just as much as going to a judge or even more powerful than the judge. So what I'm saying is what you need to do now is call an assignment of judgment.
Assignment of judgment.
Right?
Now,
assignment of judgment.
In this initial action, we have here in our circuit court, in our state court, an interest because they like now they've done this new thing where they're making they're forcing everybody to do these filings online, and they have this option for entrance of foreign judgment. Like, would that be it?
Well, you got to remember something, Noble. If I hear you correctly, let me repeat in a paraphrase. If I hear you correctly, you doing your administrative process through notary presentment. Are you telling me that they're forcing you to do it online?
Well, like all interactions with the court, they switched it where they're no longer taking cases in. Or and such at the desk, like they've got this online website thing where you pay and you file and you do everything. You kind of open up an account and everything online.
Which is good.
And you submit all
that. That's excellent. I'm happy to hear that because you can do your administrative process through that by, again, purchasing an index number, processing it online. You don't have to have no judge. You have the notary process done, and again, once the party have defaulted in the due process of the notary process, then what you would do is you go for your assignment. Now, in that notary process, if the other party defaulted, you have to send them a notice of default, and they have to cure that default within a certain amount of time,
right?
And normally you have to send that out to them, right? If they don't respond in a certain amount of time, then the notary would certify that from our notary that the party had defaulted within a certain amount of time, all right? And then after that's done, then you can do what you call is an assignment of judgment where you will be entitled judgment creditor, and the other party who defaulted would be called judgment debtor. And then what happened is you have to tally up the interest and the amount that the person defaulted and then let the notary notarize that amount as a notary process or presentment, and then you send that to the party who's in default. All right? And then what you do is take that assignment of judgment and you can process that online, as you stated, by purchasing an index number and index that judgment. All right? That's what you can do. All right? That's the process, brother.
Okay. I had to go ahead and mute the brother. You want to give us your contact information again? So that way he'll be able to call you.
Yes, he can call me. 347-626-1357. That's 347-626-1357.
Okay. I'm going to go on into this next plug so we see what we're going to do with this one.
All right.
Under fact, arrest, and coercion.
Okay, have a seat. Okay, I think we've got addressed everything. Were we in the middle of something when I got the call?
There was something else Mr. Shute brought up in regards to, and I can't remember either.
All right, Mr. Shute. Oh, we were talking about Mr. Shute wanted to read U.S. Supreme Court cases to the jury.
Yes. Reason being, since it's his job to prove that I'm a criminal, and I know that you and him are going to do everything you can to withhold evidence and facts, that I want to read United States Supreme Court cases, which pertains particularly to assault by a police officer or an illegal arrest, which is what an illegal arrest is an assault and battery. And then I would also like to read to them some U.S. Supreme Court cases in regards to licensing and traffic stops and how it is, how a judge would be in violation of his oath of office if he imposed a duty upon a licensee if the licensee was not acting for compensation.
Okay.
And that it's up to him to prove that the motor vehicle code does apply to me and that the cop did have reason to arrest me for failure to produce documents.
First, I've already ruled on those issues, and they are not jury issues. I will not allow you to read case law to the jury. It's inappropriate. The law will be I am the judge of the law. I will instruct the jury on what the law is, and you've already been provided a copy of my first draft of that charge, and that would be the charge I intend to use. You have the right to argue that based on the law applicable that other charges should be given, but I am the person who will instruct the jury as to the law. It is not appropriate for you to read cases to the jury, and I will not permit you to do so.
I object. You
That's
are
fine,
not
sir.
A judge. You are an executive administrator.
Okay.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled there are no judicial courts in America. There have not been since 1789. Judges do not enforce statutes and codes. Executive administrators enforce statutes and codes.
All right. We're done. And we'll see you tomorrow at 9:30 to go over the
tape.
Okay. I'm going to cover one other thing. I might as well cover it today, and that is, again, Mr. Shute has the right to disagree with any rulings I make. He has the right to take appropriate appeals. But, Mr. Shute, it is inappropriate for you to address those issues to the jury. And I have to tell you that if you begin to do that once we get here, and if there's an objection, I will stop you. I will tell the jury that you've been instructed not to do so. I will tell them to disregard it. And if you continue to do that, I will then have no choice but to switch over, have Mr. Neal begin representing you, and I'm not going to permit you to create a mistrial by continually making inappropriate statements to the jury. And that's a choice you're going to have to make, but it's not my intent to allow the creation of a mistrial continue statements that I've already ruled on. You have the right to go to the appellate division. The appellate division overrules me. That's the law of the case. But until the appellate division does, my ruling is the law of the case, and that's the way we're going to proceed.
I object, and I move to mistrial now.
Okay. Well, your objection is overruled, and I note it. Have a nice day.
Okay. What we got there?
Well, Noble, listen to this, because it kind of reminds me of Cheyenne's case, all right? And what we have here, Brother Tahaka, is that we are in an unfortunate forum where there's a certain decorum or procedure that is executed within that venue. And I understand what the gentleman is saying, and I'm not saying that the gentleman is wrong, but again, Brother Tahaka, you made it clear, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. He shouldn't even allow to come that far before a jury. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen to this carefully. If he's going to go into a jury trial, he can't cite case law and the jury trial. Why? Because he's going to be creating his own case law when the case is over, independently from other case laws that he's going to be citing. So if he don't want to be subjugated to that, he should have filed all his arguments from the very beginning before he even gets to trial. Now, let me use an example of what I'm about to share with you. I was in court with a Moore to gather some information on getting an order from a motion for consideration that was denied by the judge on the record. But we came back 2 weeks later. That was last week, earlier part of this week, which was Friday, where the order was not in the record, but it was stated orally on the record.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for the order because we was going to appeal the order, but because there's no order, we can't file an appeal, and there's a trial to be set down for the 28th of January. So that piece that you just played is a good example that I can show people what I'm going to do with this Morris case. So since the judge did not give us an order that we can file an appeal, she put us in a precarious situation, but technically 2 weeks ago when we was in court, the more, and please, for those who are listening, please listen carefully. If you're standing before a quote-unquote judge, I don't really call them judges, I call them mad guys in black robes, that's what I call them, all right, or lawyers in black robes, because that's what they are, they're lawyers pretending to be judges, all right, when you're standing before these individuals and they rule against you, the thing you should say is that in order? That's the first thing you should say. And if they say yes, I says, well, I like to have that order in writing. And this is what the Moore should have done. He should have said, if you're going to deny my motion, I like to have that in writing. All right? This is what he should have said. And if he would have said that, we would have had that order that same thing. But because of the fact that the Moore allowed that to go on without an order to be set down on the record, written, not verbal, but written, then we could have appealed that. So now they're not going to give us an order. Now, what the clerk said to me when we was trying to obtain the order, that we're going to have to go to the court reporter and order the minutes so we can see what was said on the record in order to be able to create an order. This is what she was saying, but of course the judge is not going to give an order. This is exactly what the clerk came back and said to me. So when I learned that the judge is not going to give an order, why? Because she don't want her order to be appealed, and the reason why she didn't want it to be appealed because she set it down for trial, so she don't want her trial to be interrupted by an appeal. Because if there's a trial coming, and if there was a written order, Brother Tahaka, that means you can file an appeal, and that means that the trial cannot happen against one because the case is in an appeal, and then suppose you overturn the case and the appeal, that means you can win your case and there would never be no trial. So in order for that not to occur, she deliberately didn't want to give an order to trap the Moore in a position where he would have to be forced to go to trial or be warranted for his arrest when they're showing up in court. So what do you do in that instance? Now, this is what we're going to do. Here's the remedy, Moore. For those who are out there listening, this is the remedy. I'm going to be doing what you call is a notice of removal from the local court into the Supreme Court, which is the court that overrides that local court, all right? So I have the procedure and what I'm going to do. I have the format, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to file a notice of removal to bring it into the Supreme Court. And once I bring it into the Supreme Court, that means that that's going to effectuate and interrupt the trial process so we can be able to win this case in another venue. All right, in the same jurisdiction, but in another venue.
Okay. All right. Now I got one more little thing here, and we're gonna move forward with what we got.
Personal jurisdiction, we are asking over whom may the court exercise its power?
Hello, I'm Rick Faulkner from Chapman University School of Law, and this is Civil Procedure. We'll begin with federal civil procedure. We begin with the subjects that are by far the most tested topics on the California bar exam. Jurisdiction and venue. It will be tremendously important for us to understand and discuss separately three distinct topics: personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, and venue. Each of these issues relates to the question of whether the plaintiff has chosen the proper court in which to file his action. Not every bar exam essay that raises questions about the proper court will require you to discuss all three of these topics. But if the call of the question does not narrow the scope of your essay, you should be prepared to discuss all three. Since it is extremely important for us to understand the distinctions between these three topics, it will help at the outset to understand what each of them is determining. Personal jurisdiction addresses the question, does the court have the power to make rulings that affect a given individual, corporation, or piece of property? In other words, with personal jurisdiction, we are asking, over whom may the court exercise its power? With subject matter jurisdiction, the question is not who, but what. We are concerned with whether the subject of the litigation is a proper one for the court to consider. As an initial matter, keep in mind that this is only an issue for federal courts, because state courts are courts of general jurisdiction, while federal courts are courts of specific jurisdiction. This simply means that state courts are typically not bound to hear cases dealing only with certain subjects. They have the power to hear cases covering pretty much the entire range of causes of action. The exception to this is certain specialized state courts, such as probate courts, but for the most part, this will not be relevant to us on the bar exam. For the bar exam, it is usually sufficient to note that in state court matters, a plaintiff will generally not be restricted from bringing an action due to the subject matter of the case. There may be specific state procedures for bringing cases, but there will be some state court available to hear the plaintiff's action. In federal court, the situation is completely different. As courts of specific jurisdiction, federal courts only have the power to hear specific enumerated types of cases. If the plaintiff's action does not fit into one of the enumerated cases the federal court can hear, the plaintiff will be unable to bring her action in federal court. Thus, for the bar exam, when the call of the question puts jurisdictional issues into play, we need to analyze federal actions to determine whether the plaintiff's action fits within the subject matter jurisdiction of federal court. The third related topic is venue. We have seen that personal jurisdiction is a question of whom. The relevant question is whether the court has power over a given defendant or property. Subject matter jurisdiction is a question of what. We are asking whether the lawsuit itself is a proper subject to be raised in federal court. With venue, the question is where. We are asking whether the court in which the plaintiff has brought his action is the proper place for the case to be litigated. Each of these three related subjects requires some in-depth understanding and analysis, so we will address each in turn. Personal jurisdiction. Recall that with personal jurisdiction, our basic question is whether the court has the power to make rulings affecting a given defendant. This is a relevant question for both state and federal courts because Rule 4 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure provides that a federal court must, in most cases, analyze personal jurisdiction as if it were a state court of the state in which the court is located. For example, an Oregon federal court must analyze personal jurisdiction as though it were an Oregon state court. Categories of personal jurisdiction. There are three different types of personal jurisdiction, each of which could come up on a bar exam essay: in personam jurisdiction, in rem jurisdiction, and quasi in rem jurisdiction. The most common and most familiar type of personal jurisdiction is in personam jurisdiction. In personam jurisdiction exists when the court has the power to make rulings affecting a specific person or corporation. If the court has such power, it may make orders that directly affect the individual or corporation, and those orders would be entitled to full faith and credit in other states. Most of the following analysis deals with in personam jurisdiction, as it is the type of jurisdiction at issue in most real-life cases, as well as most bar exam fact patterns. The question of whether the court has power over a given defendant. However, it is important to understand the other two types as well. In rem jurisdiction exists when the court has the power to adjudicate the rights of all persons, whether subject to in personam jurisdiction or not, with respect to a given item of property. The rule here is that the property must be located within the state, and it cannot have been brought into the state by force or fraud. Each state will have a series of statutes that provide for various in rem actions. For instance, in an eminent domain case, a state can exercise in rem jurisdiction over the real property to be condemned, regardless of whether it has personal jurisdiction over the individuals who are property owners. One can easily imagine a situation where someone owns property in state X, despite not living in state X, nor having any dealings with state X. Nevertheless, if state X wishes to condemn the property, it has in rem jurisdiction to do so because the property is found within state X. Similarly, when settling a decedent's estate, state X would have in rem jurisdiction to dispose of the property located within state X, regardless of whether it had in personam jurisdiction over the individuals whose property rights might be affected. This is not all that commonly tested, but just keep in mind that it can apply when dealing with property physically located within a state. The most common fact scenarios for in rem jurisdiction are condemnation actions, property forfeiture actions, and settlement of estates. The third category is quasi in rem jurisdiction. There are two types of quasi in rem jurisdiction. The first is when the court is deciding on an issue of ownership of property that is within the court's control. For example, if the issue is ownership of an automobile, and one of the parties attaches the automobile in state X to prevent its sale, the court would be exercising quasi in rem jurisdiction when determining ownership as between plaintiff and defendant. The second type of quasi in rem jurisdiction is when the court adjudicates a dispute other than ownership of property based upon the presence of defendant's property in the forum state. This is a bit trickier, so let's imagine an example. Plaintiff, a California resident, travels to Florida, gets into a car accident, and has a negligence claim against defendant for the auto accident that occurred in Florida. Defendant is a Florida resident, but owns a boat docked in California. If plaintiff attached the boat and attempted to sue in California, using the presence of defendant's property to justify the lawsuit, that would be an exercise of quasi in rem jurisdiction. There are a couple of things we need to understand about quasi in rem jurisdiction. First, it is subject to the international SHU minimum contacts rules we will discuss in a moment. In other words, in the case I just described, if defendant had no connections with California other than the boat docked there, it would be highly unlikely that the court would conclude that she could be sued in California for a claim that has nothing to do with the existence of the boat in California. By contrast, if the ownership of the boat were at issue, as in the first type of quasi in rem jurisdiction, its presence would likely be a close enough connection to permit the court to exercise jurisdiction. In addition, when the court exercises quasi in rem jurisdiction, plaintiff's recovery is going to be limited to the property at issue. In other words, if plaintiff and defendant were litigating the ownership of the boat from the previous example, and the court was exercising quasi in rem jurisdiction, it would be unable to make additional orders or awards affecting defendant beyond the ownership of the boat. The jurisdiction is limited to the property at issue. The main difference between in rem and quasi in rem jurisdiction is that in rem jurisdiction affects all persons' rights in a given piece of property, while quasi in rem only affects those individuals litigating before the court. Thus, if a court is settling an estate by determining who owns a boat that is part of the estate, that will affect everyone's rights in the boat, whether or not they are subject to jurisdiction in the state. On the other hand, if a court is determining ownership of a boat that has been attached by plaintiff, this exercise of quasi in rem jurisdiction will only affect the rights of plaintiff and defendant, not absent parties or those over whom the court has no jurisdiction. Constitutional limits of personal jurisdiction. Next, we need to understand the constitutional limits of personal
jurisdiction. Okay. Now, I wanted to play that so we can get some rules and regulations laid out, so to give us a little bit more keener insight in the workings of the court and how their little system is set up and how they do things by shedding that little light there. Brother, you was telling us, I had talked to you earlier on the phone, you was telling me that you had some new things that you wanted to bring to the table there, and so you want to bring this in up so we can get some clarity on that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that. I was kind of focusing on the audio that you played for the talk. I wanted to make a quick comment, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I can go into the new things. That was very excellent, brother. I have to commend you for that. For those who are listening, Brother Tahaka, that is what I'm referring to when the procedure is understood concerning jurisdiction and venue. All right. Matter of fact, he also explained, the brother who said he had a case when people who was in the state of Detroit and outside of the state of Detroit. And, of course, that would be quasi. So he didn't make mention of that. He articulated that very well for people to understand that. But he made an issue concerning federal being of specific jurisdiction, all right, because he was saying that the courts, state courts, have, of course, general jurisdiction, so they can go all the way across the board on any issue within their jurisdiction. This is what he was saying. But the federal court is only specific, which means he's stating that they have limited jurisdiction. Now, there's an issue there because I have to disagree with him with that point, all right? And we don't want to be misled for what this individual said, all right? When you go to Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, all right, Article 6, Clause 2 specifically says, this Constitution and laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and every the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in this constitutional laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So when you read that, Brother Tahaka, Article 6, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution, showing that the treaties and laws, the Constitution and treaties is the supreme law of the land, how could you make a statement by saying that the federal court has specific jurisdiction and the state courts have general jurisdiction? That doesn't make sense. So I have to point that out, all right? And this is where the Moors come in, because most Moors that I know of would always cite that statute and that clause, second clause, Article 6, that every judge, as I said again, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the constitutional laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So, again, that's something that you would have to be aware of, all right, because these Europeans, even though they may break down their jurisdiction in reference to personam, in reference to subject matter, and in reference to in realms or territorial jurisdiction, they may make mention of these things, or even quasi, all right? And he's giving you a good breakdown, which is good that he articulate that so you can have an idea how this thing works, how this thing operates. But at the same time, I had to read Article 6, Clause 2, to show that if these state judges are bound notwithstanding, then how could you say the federal court jurisdiction is specific, meaning that it's limited? So I had to bring that out, Brother Doc.
Okay. Well, I can't put too much past it because he's a lawyer. I got another caller in there. Let me get the other caller in there.
Yes, Noble.
Okay. Area code 205. Tell us who you are, where you calling from, and what's your question or comment. Area code 205. Okay. All right. Now, you was about to tell us about the new.
Brother Talk, there's just so much going on.
Okay. Well, hold on 1 second. Hold on 1 second. Area code 347.
Hey, hello. Yeah, this is what's going on. I just got a quick question. As far as obtaining a copy of a judge oath of office, like I live in the New York State, like I've been trying to find out how to get a copy of it, but it's like every time I call these so-called establishments, they always give me the runaround. So is there like a website or like a main place where they go? Because I know they have to like record it on file for public record, things of that nature, public viewing, should I say?
What was the question again? You said something about a judgment. I'm not clear.
Yeah, he wants to know where would he go to pull up a judge's oath of office?
In the New York area. I'm in Brooklyn.
In New York area.
Brooklyn.
What is it? 25 Beaver Street. Noble, you with me?
No, I had to mute his mic. He got background noise, but he's in Brooklyn.
Right.
He's
20, right. You got you. 25 Beaver Street. It is a website that you can go to. Is the Court of Administration, which is at 25 Beaver Street, if I'm not mistaken, at 2nd Avenue, all right, in Manhattan. All right, that's the Court of Administration. The main place, that's one of the places, but the main place is the appellate division or the appellate court, all right? It's basically where you will find the judge's oath of office also, all right? So there are two locations that you can find that. But try 25 Beaver Street, all right, in Manhattan. You can go to the website and type in Court of Administration, all right, in Manhattan, and it's probably going to most likely give you 25 Beaver Street. And you can go to that site. You got a telephone number. You can call up and tell them under the Freedom of Information law you would like to obtain a specific judge's oath of office. All right? That's what you say, Noble. You use the term public officer's law, all right? Because under the public officer's law, they already know they have to give you that information. All right, so if it's a specific judge, oath of office, you can go into the website, see their number. You can call them up on Monday, all right, and the office should be open. And under the Freedom of Information law, under the public officer's law, you're requesting a specific judge's oath of office, a copy of the oath that should be on file that's made public. All right, they will give it to you, Noble, so that's not an issue, because I've done that in the past. Please.
Okay. Now, I'm pretty sure that answered this question. I had to.
One other thing, that's interrupting you. This is something else people need to be aware of, too. You can use that same public officer's law, which is the Freedom of Information, and from the comptroller's office, you can also inquire about the judge's insurance policy. Because it just dawned on me as the brother was asking about the judge's oath of office, and people don't seem to realize we ain't just talking about the judge's oath of office, all right? If you're trying to go after that judge family, you need to try out the insurance policy, which is public record also. The comptroller's office have that, all right? So once you get the judge's oath of office, listen to me carefully. Once you get the judge's oath of office, what you can do is put in the Freedom of Information request to the comptroller's office also, and you can request a copy of the judge's insurance policy, because that's what? Also public record, because you can let them know that you are a citizen within the city of New York, and as a citizen, you would like to, you know, for public record, you like to see if the judge's policy, insurance policy, is in good standing for public inspection. For public inspection, is that what you say? That's the reason why you want to get a copy of his policy for public inspection, all right? Because a lot of us don't realize that you can get obtained of the judge's insurance policy now, which most people recognize it as the judge's bond, but it's also called the insurance policy. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm saying that, because once you begin to start putting a lien on his insurance policy or filing a complaint to this insurance company, that will be marked on his bond, and his credit rating would go down. And if his credit rating goes down too much, the insurance company would drop him, and he would not be insured. And if he cannot be insured, that means he can't perform public duty because he's not insured or indemnified for any liabilities as a judge on the seat. And this is how you can get rid of him from working, all right? You can remove him permanently. You know, you don't have to worry about him recusing himself from the bench. You can remove him by putting a complaint, which is a claim on or lien on his on public insurance policy. Please.
Okay. I think I've made mention of that a while back in previous broadcasts, but I'm glad you re-brought that out this evening. Brother, we only have about 9 minutes left. Is there anything that you want to bring to the table that we might have missed?
Yes. What I wanted to share, Brother Tahaka, there was a Moor who was dealing with a family court case, and mm-hmm. I'm going to be appealing this case because I did what you call as a notice of objection. In family court, when you having any issues concerning a magistrate in that family court, all right, you cannot appeal their orders. You can only file what you call as a notice of objection. You see, we've got so much clandestine administration procedure that if you don't know the procedure, you'll wind up wavering certain rights that you may have. So when you file a notice of objection, this is what they do up in New York. If you're in family court, you have to file what you call is a notice of objection if the magistrate or the support magistrate files any orders against you, and then you have 30 days to file that objection. And when you file that objection, it goes before the family court judge, and then they're going to make a ruling on that objection. And if they rule in your favor, then you overturn the magistrate judge. If not, then you have to file an appeal from that judge, which I'm going to be doing, all right? And, of course, the judge did make her order in detail, and I know that we don't have enough time, Brother Tahaka, but one of the things that the judge did cite in her order was under civil practice law and rules, subsection 301 and 302. 301 specifically talks about jurisdiction over persons, property, mm-hmm. or status, which is the same thing that the gentleman was deliberating on as he was playing him. And it states here that a court may exercise such jurisdiction over persons, property, or status as might have been exercised heretofore. And then under Section 302, it says personal jurisdiction by acts of non-domiciliary, all right, which means mm-hmm. if you're not a resident of the state, they're saying that they can exercise jurisdiction over you. And under Section 4B, it talks about personal jurisdiction over non-resident defendant in matrimonial actions or family court proceedings. A court may, in any matrimonial action or family court proceeding involving a demand for support, alimony, maintenance, distributive award, or special relief in a matrimonial actions may exercise personal jurisdiction over the respondent or defendant, notwithstanding the fact that he or she no longer is a resident or domiciled of this state or over his or her executor or administrator if the party seeking support is a resident of or domiciled in this state at the time such demand is made, provided that the state was the matrimonial domicile of the parties before the separation, or the defendant abandoned the plaintiff in this state, or the claim for support, alimony, maintenance, distributive award, or special relief in matrimonial actions accrued under the laws of this state or under the agreement executed in this state. So now, why I'm making mention of this real quickly, Brother Tahaka, is because the Moor never received proper service, all right? Mm-hmm. And when the affidavit of service was submitted to the family court and we got a copy of it, because I told them all to go get his file, like I always keep saying in class, get a copy of your file and then read the statute. And when he got the copy of the file and I reviewed the affidavit of service, there was a section in there that the party was supposed to fill out, which they failed to fill out. And in that, it showed that the party did not check off, which was supposed to be the must. Was it a summons? Was it a petition? Or was it a motion or order that was served? That section was never filled out. So that was an incomplete affidavit of service, because it doesn't show what the party was served with. All right, and that was our argument, showing that she couldn't possibly serve him because she never checked off what documents that they claiming that they served. So of course the family court is arguing that that a petitioner can file for a claim and that the court would have jurisdiction. True, that's a true statement. That's only providing that the person who petition is being filed against is personally and properly served, and that never happened, all right? And that's what we was arguing, all right? But the judge, dilatorily, who's a lawyer to me, all right, is making it seem like as though the court got jurisdiction over his person, or because the petitioner went to go file a petition, that's bull crap, all right? The court doesn't have jurisdiction because a petitioner filed a petition. The person, by law, has to give notice and opportunity to be heard, and that's due the service of due process. And if the person have never been served properly, all right, the court do not have jurisdiction, all right, to even hear that petition, because that party has to prove that that person has been served, all right? And the court failed to review that affidavit of service and then didn't acknowledge or refused to acknowledge what was being served. So how could you say that it was a petition? How could you say that it was a summons? How could you say it was an order to show cause if it was never checked off on what papers was so said, served, brother, to Hawker? So I had to bring that out.
Okay, brother. Well, I certainly appreciate you being with us this evening, and you got to get back with us next Sunday so we can continue giving a breakdown on the law and the different procedures in civil, state, and federal. And I also want to let the audience know that we'll be back here Wednesday, and we'll be doing part two of driver's license versus freedom. So you all stay tuned for that broadcast. Brother, I certainly appreciate you being here, and I look forward to seeing you next weekend.
Oh, definitely. And Brother Tahaka, I meant to tell you I'm coming down there, brother.
Okay, well, come on down to the summit, man. We'll be right here. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we look forward to seeing y'all on our next broadcast. So y'all have a good evening, okay?
It's been a long time since I've seen. It's been a long, long time since I held a woman. Yeah.
Since I held
a woman. In the heart of me, it's in the hell. Yeah. Why don't you hurt it?
I got what you need, and I'm gonna set you free with a hurry. Bring your body to me. I got what you need. And